Welcome to a special non-Grateful Dead Zone edition of, well, some great music. In the background, that is Jesse Ed Davis, and we're going to devote 2 hours to the great Jesse Ed Davis with Professor Douglas Miller, who has written an amazing book called Ouachita Love Child, The Rise of Indigenous Rockstar. Yes, Jesse Ed Davis is going to be joining me in just a second. This is going to be a great ride, so strap in and, get ready to hear some music you may have heard before, but in a context I guarantee you have never heard before.
Wish I was back in the city, but instead out of this old bank of sand. With the sun beating down over the chimney tops and the one I love so close at hand. If I had wings and I could fly, I know where I would go. But right now I just sit here so contentedly and watch the river flow. People disagreeing on just about everything, yeah. Makes you stop and wonder why. Why only yesterday I saw somebody on the street who just couldn't help but cry. Oh, but this old river keeps on rolling though. No matter what gets in the way and which way the wind does blow. And as long as it does, I just sit here and watch the river flow.
I'm speaking with Douglas Miller, a Department of History professor at Oklahoma State University. Is that in Tulsa? Is that where OSU is?
Well, I'm in Stillwater, which is just an hour west of Tulsa.
And you wrote this amazing book. I got your book because I read books like yours, and it just carried me away. I knew something about Jesse Ed Davis, but I didn't know a lot. And a lot of what I knew, and it maybe you can tell our listeners this story about how a lot of people may have discovered him. Let's discuss February 19th, 1987. What is going on at the Palomino Club in North Hollywood?
Well, that's sort of a legendary night, highly mythologized. It's not really mythologized, I suppose, because everything that happened is true. Jesse Ed Davis was at the old Palomino Club in out there in Los Angeles. I think it's in North Hollywood, but that's off the top of my head. Don't quote me on that. And he was playing with a bunch of friends of his. A group he had formed called the Graffiti Man Band, in which he performed with a Dakota poet, a fellow Native American artist named John Trudell, and a great group of musicians, including Gary Ray and Bobby Tsukamoto, and Mark Shark. And they were there performing their own set and also backing the great Taj Mahal, another old friend of Jesse Ed Davis's. I'm sure we'll talk about that. And as well, in the audience that night were none other than Bob Dylan, George Harrison, and John Fogerty. And before that event ended, somewhere around 2 o'clock in the morning, all of those guys would be up on stage together playing some great jams, including Watching the River Flow, which we just heard in the lead up.
So this is network on a super level. And why, you know, again, for people, why were all those musicians there to watch Jesse Ed Davis?
Jesse Ed Davis was in the middle of a comeback, or a couple of comebacks. One in terms of his career, his music artistry, playing with the Graffiti Band. And the other one was a comeback in terms of his health. This is just over 1 year before Jesse would pass at the young age of 43 in 1988. And Jesse was really kind of getting his life back on track. And Bob Dylan was hanging out with George Harrison there in town and said, hey, why don't we go down and see Jesse play with his Graffiti band? Dylan was already hip to these guys and was a big fan. And as I understand it, Bob Dylan intentionally went to the club that night to drum up some media enthusiasm for Jesse's relatively new music project with Graffiti Man. And it worked. The news media jumped all over this. And each gig the Graffiti Band did after that night in February 1987, the crowds got bigger and bigger thanks to some famous friends of Jesse Ed Davis showing up to show him some support.
Well, if we were constructing a movie not unlike A Complete Unknown, which I referred to, that would have been the great opening scene. You know what I'm saying? We're setting the table. This extraordinary musician, this guitarist, and the biggest stars on the planet show up to lend support and promote him, including, you know, Bob Dylan, who is not the most outgoing person in the world and certainly doesn't do media events. So that's our opening of the film. The book, your book is as much a history of Tulsa and the indigenous population and the confluences of history and art. You're a professor of history, and it's written with that historical perspective. And just a bit about Jesse Ed's upbringing, like his mom, his dad, his family, just where did he come from? What are his roots? And the key is, this is an indigenous Native American musician who transcended all of it and became one of the definitive Oklahoma musicians, but never lost his roots. But to set the stage, now we're going back in time, you know, you go into great detail on his genealogy and upbringing, but paint a quick picture of who this guy was and who his family were and where he came from.
Yeah, you know, I like the way that you put something a moment ago when you said Jesse Ed Davis never lost his roots. That's right. And a lot of these stories about Native American people in the 20th century, the way the kind of fictionalized version goes is that Native American people forget that they're Native American, or they have to sort of rediscover their indigenous culture and roots because of, you know, understandably so, years, centuries even of assimilation programs that, you know, various governments and military parties tried to enact on Native people. But that's not really Jesse's story. He didn't even really have to transcend being an indigenous person. He brought it with him when he moved from Oklahoma to California. And now I'm jumping ahead. Jesse Ed Davis was born in Norman, Oklahoma, where his father had just come back from World War II fighting in the Navy. And Jesse was born in a naval hospital in Norman. Jesse's father was a Comanche, Seminole, Muscogee, and Cheyenne person. Jesse's mother was a Kiowa person. She was the first Kiowa woman to ever earn a bachelor's degree from the University of Oklahoma. And she was the daughter of the chief of the Kiowa Nation. So Jesse's parents were very prominent people, so much so that I suggest in the book that Jesse had a lot to live up to in terms of their example. Now, in Jesse's telling, in his own autobiographical tune called Ouachita Love Child, the namesake of the book, Jesse says, I was born on the banks of the Ouachita River in a Kiowa Comanche teepee. Now, that's more of a metaphor than reality. But the point is, Jesse came from Oklahoma. He was born and raised here. And he would have some pretty extraordinary experiences before he ever went out to Los Angeles and hooked up with Leon Russell and Bob Dylan and a whole coterie of great musicians. But back here in Oklahoma is where the story started.
Well, why don't we, you name checked it. Let's hear Ouachita Love Child. This is from Jesse Ed's first record, Jesse Davis. And I don't believe he's on guitar here, but one of his other famous friends. What's that guy's name, the other guitar player he used to hang out with? The name escapes me. Who was that guy? Oh, yeah.
Eric Clapton.
So Clapton just cooks on this. And Clapton, of course, you know, this – Jesse Ed Davis was like this crossroads. Everybody loved the guy. Everybody recognized what a great musician he was. And he just was an extraordinary personality. So it wasn't an accident that he attracted people like this. But this is Jesse Ed Davis telling his own fairly fictionalized story. This is Eric Nelson. I'm here with Douglas Miller, and it's not the Grateful Dead Zone today, folks. It's a two-hour deep dive into the wondrous music and life of the great Jesse Ed Davis. Little psychedelic there. Ouachita Love Child, featuring a not-so-slow hand, Eric Clapton. This is Eric Nelson. I'm here with Professor, can I call you Professor Doug? Professor Douglas Miller, is that okay?
Sure, that's fine with me.
Yeah, because it's not often you're classing up the joint here, an authentic history professor occupying this time slot. So reading the book, I was struck by, like so many of guitar gods, including Eric Clapton and, all of them basically, he got hooked very early and was an obsessive musician. That's what he did. His identity was formed first and foremost, not being a Native American, but by being a guitarist. And his chops got very good very quick. Can you give us like an overview of his early days, get us up to, say, Taj Mahal time?
Yeah, well, you know, back to Oklahoma, you know, Jesse said it this way himself in kind of a winking way. He said, I'm an urban Indian. An urban Indian has all kinds of historical connotations that, you know, we could take the rest of our program time to elaborate on that context. But, you know, what Jesse was suggesting was that he was born in a city and he was raised in a city, in Oklahoma City, which is a much bigger city even at the time in the 1950s and into the 1960s than most people might recognize. Jesse lived in a sort of middle, almost upper class neighborhood. His parents worked at Tinker Air Force Base. Jesse went to public schools. Now, he was often the only Native American kid in his entire school, and that could make his social circumstances a little challenging and difficult, to say the least. But he was in a family trio. Lord, it was just us three, Jesse said in that song that we just heard. Mom, Dad, and Jesse, or Eddie, as they called him when he was
an only child, which never hurts to have gifted parents and be an only child.
Sure. And, he got a lot of good attention from mom and dad, and that often came in the form of music. So not only did his mom and dad have a formidable collection of old 45s and 78s, they had a lot of music instruments laying around the house. Jesse's dad was a drummer. His mom was a pianist. And Jesse grew up in a music environment. But now fast forward to about 1959, I think, Jesse's Kiowa grandfather died. And as is cultural tradition, his family practiced 1 year of mourning where they really diminished their social activities. And that gave Jesse a lot of time sitting around the house. And you mentioned he was obsessed with that guitar, and he would just sit on his bed in his bedroom for hours and hours and days on end, teaching himself to play. Growing up in Oklahoma City, he formed several bands. And by the time he got to college in 1962, he was starting to go on the road with his own band, and eventually, to his friend's surprise, he ends up in a band with Conway Twitty, of all people, who had already had a number one hit by that point. Jesse takes to the road a little more with Conway Twitty, and before you know it, he's going to be out in Los Angeles where he'll meet Taj Mahal.
But a fascinating footnote. Again, I'm a Bob Dylan fan and a band fan. Jesse hooked up and idolized another Native American or Native American Canadian guitar player, and that would be Robbie Robertson before the band were the band, back when they were the Hawks, pre-Bob Dylan. Was it safe to say that Jesse Ed Davis was something of a Hawks groupie, following them around, watching licks when they're playing, you know, Jack Ruby's nightclub in Dallas or Tony Mart's, you know, the club circuit that Conway Twitty was on with was this interesting circuit that wasn't getting hits, but highly evolved bar bands. And Conway Twitty and Jesse Ed Davis were one, and LeVon and the Hawks were another. It kind of illuminate, because that's just if everyone, you know, if you're casual Dylan fans would say, oh yeah, the Hawks, you know, that was Dylan's backup band in 66. And then they did music from Big Pink. But we forget that they started with Ronnie Hawkins. Then they went their separate ways. And from, say, 63, 64, 65, they were the hardest working bar band in America and North America, basically, with the exception perhaps of Conway Twitty and Jesse Ed Davis.
Absolutely. And for a brief period, they were LeVon and the Hawks when LeVon Helm was leading the band. And I love that the whole program here opened with Jesse's instrumental tune called Big Dipper. For a couple of reasons. One, the Big Dipper is really important in Kiowa people's cosmology. But as well, there was an amusement park just across the field from the house Jesse grew up in Oklahoma City. They had a roller coaster there called the Big Dipper, and boy, did Jesse Ed Davis love it. And in addition to that roller coaster, there was a band shell. And Jesse would cross that field all the time to go see whomever was playing. You could see Johnny Cash for 50 cents. You could see Conway Twitty, of course. And you could see Ronnie and the Hawks. And Jesse loved Robbie Robertson's guitar playing. Jesse would stand right in the front row, get as close as he could to Robbie Robertson so he could watch his fingers on the fretboard. And yeah, eventually they become friends. And when Jesse ends up in Conway Twitty's group, they even start doing gigs together. And in terms of Jesse, yeah, being a Hawks groupie, yeah, there's a great story in the book about Jesse and his buddy John Ware, who would go on to play with Emmylou Harris and Mike Nesmith and others. They drove all the way to Toronto up in Ontario just to hang out with the Hawks because they were such big fans. And when they got there, they found out they weren't supposed to be in the club because they weren't
of age,
proper age. Yeah.
And I think they somehow, I think LeVon used his Razorback charm to implore the club owner to let them in to watch the gig. Now, chronological wise, Oklahoma at that moment was, you talk about an epicenter for some great musicians, and I'm talking about one Russell Bridges, is that his name? This piano player, local piano player who went on to some fame?
Sure thing. And, you know, I like to tell people as they're picking up the book, as I always say, I hope you'll be as surprised as I was and still am about all the interesting twists and turns and connections in the book that no fiction writer could make up. And one is that when Leon Russell was still known as Russell Bridges, his piano teacher had been the same piano teacher of Jessie Davis's mom, Vivian Sonkey. All these cool connections in the story. But Leon Russell had his whole sort of gang of Okie musicians coming up in Tulsa. But Jesse and his crew never actually met those guys back in Oklahoma. Jesse liked to quip. He had to move all the way to Los Angeles to meet a bunch of guys who were right down the road in Tulsa. But as well, you know, Tulsa and Oklahoma City might as well have been 1,000 miles apart at that time. So Jesse will meet Leon Russell and fall in with his gang out in Los Angeles, and they'll make some great music together.
And that, so Jesse now is in Los Angeles, what, 1966, 67. Is this when he's hooking up with Leon and Leon's, I don't know what we'd call it, commune, extended family, or was that after the Taj Mahal days?
It's kind of all happening at once. So back to the band, or the Hawks as they're still known, right? Levon Helm had just left the Hawks when they were out on tour with Bob Dylan.
Oh, because he didn't want to get booed. He's like,
he didn't want to get booed.
Yeah, yeah. LeVon, yeah, and he goes to work, I think, on an oil rig for a while and then finds his way out. Yeah, but he just was like, I'm not going to play when they're booing me every night. You do it. So, and Sandy Konnikoff, yeah. Sandy Konnikoff briefly drums, you know, with Dylan in the band. He's one of the, before Mickey Johns joins, Konnikoff is actually part of the touring ensemble with Bob Dylan. But I know it seems like there's like 10 musicians and they're all playing on everyone's, but I'm getting into too much arcana. So let's get what happens now? He's in L.A.?
Yeah, well, Sandy Konnikoff will end up playing in Jesse's band, but that's another story. And so so Jesse, he's still going by the – now he's calling himself Ed Davis. He's a little older now. He's Ed Davis. He's staying at his granddad's house in Silver Lake. But soon he gets in touch with Levon, and Levon says, well, you know, come on over. You got to meet some guys. And that group included Leon Russell and Junior Markham, Carl Radle, this great coterie of Okie musicians. Meanwhile, Taj Mahal had just, experienced the breakup of his band called the Rising Suns, but he still had a record deal with Columbia.
And now he
needed to put a new band together. Heard about this guy, Ed Davis.
Well, yeah. You know this. Who was Taj Mahal's, who was also in the Rising Suns with Taj Mahal?
Yeah, Ry Cooter, among others.
Yeah, Ry Cooter. So again, like 10 musicians. So yeah, so Taj Mahal's putting together a new band. And what I gather from your book is Leon, it's this weird, Manson light community. It's a cult. If Manson was all darkness and evil, but weird living conditions, Leon Russell and his Okie buddies had a hippie house with a commune, tons of girls in and out, this whole utopian musical scene going on that all revolved around then staggeringly successful session musician Leon Russell. And I guess Jesse Davis got the couch. He moves in. He immediately is loved by everybody, must have done his dishes or whatever you do in a hippie household. And he's just hanging in the commune, right?
Yeah, you know, Leon called it a hippie commune bona fide. Those are his words. And they start out at this place called Sky Hill Studios at the foot of the Hollywood Hills. And it's a house with a studio built in. And literally, not figuratively, literally, like, random people would be sleeping in the closets, you know, just trying to make this whole operation work.
But random
the great
people
drummer,
like
Jimmy.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, but like
yeah,
Carl.
Well,
yeah, sorry.
Yeah. Carl Radel and Johnny Cale, J.J. Cale, and you know, various people would drop by,
Bobby
like
Rand
Parsons and
yeah.
others,
yeah.
Bobby Whitlock, David Teagarden, and so forth.
So the Mark guts Beto. Of Derek and the Dominoes then are there. Speaking of Dwayne Allman, who would get his guitar licks off of Stateboro Blues, we'll maybe talk about that story. And they're all, and that's where Taj Mahal, you know, is there a guitar player in the house? And Taj, isn't that pretty much what happens? He heard about Jesse Ed, heard him, and that was it, right? Love at first sight.
Yeah, Taj got a tip on this exciting, you know, guitarist who's playing at this club called the Ash Grove. And Taj goes out to see him. And as Taj explained to me, he said he knew within seconds the sound just washed over him. You know, he saw like the aura around Jesse up on stage. And this is the guy. Now, in the meantime, Leon's whole gang is starting to shift to a different place over in Sherman Oaks that they call the Plantation because they were working so hard. They all thought that they were working like slaves for the record business, as they told it. And the Taj Mahal band will end up practicing at this place called the Plantation, which is sort of like part two of the hippie commune.
Well, let's play some music now. Speaking of Taj Mahal, Bacon Fat. I think this was a request from you, Doug, to play this. This is a live track with Taj Mahal and this amazing and I think unfairly celebrated band that still has not gotten the attention it deserves. But this is from the Giant Step album. And, well, you can clearly hear Jesse Ed Davis. And in case you're missing him, Taj is going to make sure you know who's playing when. Thank you.
Christmas. That lonesome home, because everything is all right, you understand. You know, it's really good to play for y'all out there on the end of this here phonograph needle, you know, tickle your auditory nerves, you know.
They got any looser, they would unravel completely. It's a great. Now, there's a recipe there. The song's called Bacon Fat. And your book, Douglas Miller, Ouachita Love Child, about Jesse Ed Davis, also contains a recipe that I liked around the song Bacon Fat. Can you recall that?
Yeah, well, the song's connected to Oklahoma City. There's a restaurant there, a steakhouse, where they served something called Shore Patrol Salad. And the story behind that's pretty funny and interesting, but it's basically a salad where you pour hot bacon grease on it and intentionally wilt the lettuce and make it soggy. And the guys in the Hawks, you know, back to them, Robbie Robertson, Levon Helm, Richard Manuel, and so forth, they loved to get Shore Patrol Salad at the steakhouse after a gig in OKC. So Jesse Ed Davis and his buddies, as they were coming up in the music circuit and Hawks fans, they would start to go there after their gigs too, thinking that's what all the big star musicians would do and get this salad. And, you know, when you ordered your salad and it hit the table, you're supposed to yell out bacon fat. And that's part of the story as it pertains to Oklahoma City. But it's actually an older tune that the Hawks would cover in their set as well, from an artist named Andre Williams. So Taj Mahal did a version of it. Jesse did a version of the tune as well on his third solo album, Keep Me Coming. Great tune.
Well, we started with Statesboro Blues, and I briefly talked about the influence, my head blowing when I first heard it, because being a huge Allman Brothers fan, Allman Brothers at the Fillmore East, that great version of it, and pretty much note for note cover of Jesse Ed Davis solo. And Duane, being the gentleman he was, kind of explain that a little bit, the connection, the how Duane discovered Jesse Ed Davis and how, you know, where that led to.
Yeah, I mean, there are a few variations of the story, but I take the version I include in the book straight from Greg Allman, you know, trusting him as the greatest authority on it. And so Greg and Duane were in the middle of a big argument, just some kind of brotherly feud. Duane had recently had a horseback riding accident and was laid up in bed, and it was his birthday. And Greg wanted to do something to cheer his brother up and stop all the arguing. So he went to the store and got him some pain relief pills. And while he was there, he picked up this album from this, you know, this artist Taj Mahal he had heard a little bit about. I guess it's back in the days when you could buy vinyl at the drugstore.
Yeah, you know? Exactly. It's,
seems odd now. But Greg went to his brother's pad and he rang the doorbell and left the album and the bottle of medicine at the door and ran off because his brother didn't want to talk to him. About an hour later, Duane calls Greg and said, "Baby brother, you got to get your behind over here. You have got to hear this album." Greg beelines back to Duane's apartment, and Duane is sitting in there using the empty bottle of pain relief pills as a slide, and he's playing along to this Taj Mahal album and this song Statesboro Blues and trying to figure out what this guy Jesse Ed Davis is doing on this song. And hey man, the rest is history. Statesboro Blues is going to be one of the great Allman Brothers tunes as well.
And the, listening to like Bacon Fat, the, part of what I hear listening to Jesse's guitar is what he's not playing. This is not a flashy guitar player. You know, we heard Ouachita Lovechild with Clapton burning it up, you know, every note and brilliantly, but it's a whole different kind of playing. There's an, I would call it an organic guitar. I don't know if it's the Telecaster or not, because I know it, Robbie Robertson had that same organic guitar, or as Bob Dylan referred to Robbie, a mathematical guitar genius. And Jesse had that too. And another huge fan of the Tele and that kind of organic song sound is, oh yeah, Bruce Springsteen swears by Teles totally, entirely, not a Strat guy. And maybe it's the instrument, maybe it's the player, maybe it's both.
I think it's a little bit of everything, although, you know, the old cliche is that, you know, a great musician can make anything sound good, and I think Jesse fell into that category. He's identified most frequently with the Telecaster in terms of, you know, he had two Telecasters that are kind of his iconic guitars in terms of his story and artistry, but those Telecasters really cut through, and Jesse would crank his amp up to, you know, sort of ear bleeding volumes.
211, as they say.
But yeah. 211, sure. And right. And he'd play with a really soft and sensitive touch in his right hand. So he had this sort of immense volume dynamics right at his fingertips in the way he played. In terms of lighting it up, I asked everybody I interviewed for the book. I interviewed tons of guitar players who played with Jesse and knew him personally. And I always asked them, could Jesse really like light it up if he wanted to? And they said, oh, you know, brother, you better believe it. He didn't want to. That just wasn't his approach to the guitar. Jesse really loved the old foundational blues guitarists and the sort of early rock and roll guitar players. And moreover, a lot of his style came not from guitar players, but from pianists like Otis Spann, saxophone players like Junior Walker and Roland Kirk. And he used to play along to the horn section on old Count Basie orchestra records. Jesse was just coming at this stuff from a very different angle, and he didn't want to go out and grab the spotlight. He kind of wanted to ease his way into the song, sort of like we just heard there on Bacon Fat.
Well, let's get Jesse Ed Davis. Oh, somehow he's going to go to England. He's going to hook up with The Stones loved him. He's going to wind up playing sessions with basically every Beatle but Paul McCartney, but still be around when Paul and John met for the last musical time, I think, in a studio in 1974. He goes from sleeping on Leon Russell's couch, touring with Taj Mahal, who, by the way, would play gigs with the Grateful Dead. And if you're listening, expecting the Grateful Dead zone, no, but we're dealing with another guitar genius here on KSQD. How does he get to England, and how does that whole – he becomes Jesse Ed Davis, not fastest, but in-demand studio guitar player with true rock royalty. How does that happen?
Well, the Taj Mahal band was playing the Whiskey A Go-Go opening for Big Mama Thornton. And at some point during the set, the Taj Mahal band looks down and it's Mick Jagger, Keith Richards, Brian Jones, and a bunch of women in with them all dancing, just really boogieing down to the Taj Mahal set. And after the gig, the Taj and Jesse and those guys approached the Stones, and Taj said, "Hey, man, you know, if you're big fans, just let us know if there's ever anything we can do for you. If you ever see a spot for us or something, don't hesitate. You know, we're working hard out here and, you know, trying to get a break." And 1 month later, the band got tickets in the mail to go to London in December 1968 and appear in a movie that the Stones were going to make called The Rock and Roll Circus that would feature John Lennon and Eric Clapton, The Who, Jethro Tull, a bunch of artists. And the Taj Mahal band flew in and performed as part of this film, which didn't really see the light of day until 1995 after Jesse had passed. Maybe we'll get into that later.
Well, happen to have a track queued up from that. How about that? We can
Let's check it out.
This is Taj Mahal with Jesse Ed Davis on the Rolling Stone Rock and Roll Circus. Yeah, which they filmed. I think Michael Lindsay Hogg directed it, who shot, really directed Peter Jackson's Get Back. Even though Peter Jackson recut it, it's still Michael Lindsay Hogg's film, and it was definitely rock royalty. But this is Taj Mahal, and I can imagine Keith Richards, Eric Clapton, John Lennon watching very attentively as Taj and Jesse essayed this particular song.
Together, people, we got to do it all.
Take that, English rock royalty. I think, Douglas Miller, that the band on Islands covered Ain't That a Lot of Love. I won't say returned the favor, but that was a band cover of the last band studio album that featured the original lineup. This is Eric Nelson. I'm here with Douglas Miller, who wrote a fantastic book called Ouachita Love Child about Jesse Ed Davis. And you also curated the exhibit that's currently at the Bob Dylan Center in Tulsa, Oklahoma. So all roads are leading to Bob Dylan and Oklahoma, actually. Oklahoma is the epicenter now, and finally getting the appreciation it deserves is one of music's formative geographical regions. And what is it with Oklahoma? You know, what's in the water or with the tornadoes out there?
Yeah, well, you know, I grapple with that question in the book. And, you know, there are a couple things going on here. One is that, you know, geographically, I mean, we're as much of a crossroads as you're going to find in the United States. Environmentally, we're one of the most diverse states in the nation in terms of you can be in the desert, the Southwest, and in sort of a lush forest area in the Northeast. But Oklahoma, and I do this exercise with my students, I always ask them, hey, where are we, by the way? Are we in the Southwest or the South or the Southern Plains or the Midwest or the West? What the heck is Oklahoma? And we usually arrive at this idea that it's kind of none of the above or all of the above at once. It's just an incredibly rich place in terms of music legacies and culture and people who experienced a hard existence, either people who moved here to try to start a new life against the odds in a tough environment, or you know, Native American people and nations that were fighting for their lives and for their sovereignty and for the endurance of their culture and societies and so forth. So my point is, music here, I think, is especially cathartic, and it can be especially jubilant in terms of capturing the spirit of life during difficult times. And yeah, that's probably true anywhere to some degree. I wouldn't suggest otherwise. But here in Oklahoma, it's maybe just a little bit more animated. And then it has that distinction of absorbing all these different cultures from these different directions that came to Oklahoma. And it makes the place relatively unique.
Well, we've gotten in this last hour, we've gotten Jesse Ed from Oklahoma, from Leon Russell's couch to the set of the Rock and Roll Circus. Now he's coming back at, say, 1970, 71, and he's the guy. He's one of the hottest session guitarists in the West. And did that just sort of come organically because he hung out with Leon Russell and just everyone, you know? What was it besides his musical prowess? It just strikes me that he was just kind of a cool, mellow guy to hang out with. People just liked Jesse Ed Davis.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, reaching back to an earlier stage in our conversation, he wasn't a flash guitarist. He was a really sensitive player who cared about elevating the song and elevating the musicians around him. And I think that drew in people like John Lennon and Leon Russell, Bob Dylan, and these great musicians who wanted to play with him. Moreover, Jesse was just a real student of music, not just as a guitar player, but the history of music. He had a pretty encyclopedic knowledge of music history, as I understood it. And he could keep up with other, you know, folks like George Harrison and John Lennon who could boast the same. So he just, you know, he had a deep, soulful connection with his guitar and with his artistry. And that made him kind of magnetic as a musician. You know, there's a part too where he's Native American in a world where there aren't many Native people. And I think that made him interesting on a personal and cultural level too. But in the end, those people really wanted his guitar on their albums.
Well, let's get we're going to start our second hour. You've name-checked some of the people we're going to hear from. We're going to hear from Leon Russell in just a sec. I think we're going to hear one more track from that memorable Bob Dylan session. Here's some interesting artists that he played with and made into Jesse Ed Davis records. This is KSQD. In fact, I think I have to play the official promo here to remind the world exactly who we are and where we are.
KSQD Santa Cruz 90.7 FM, KSQT Prunedale 89.7 FM, and Translator K208GE Monterey 89.5 FM.
Doug, there'll be a short quiz on all of that information when we're done. But we know, and I remember seeing this film in 1971, seeing Concert for Bangladesh, and there in full splendor is Jesse Ed Davis on stage. We're not going to go on stage at the Concert for Bangladesh, but we've brought up Leon Russell, we've brought up Bob Dylan, we've brought up the taste and precision of Jesse Ed Davis. So let's start our second set off with Leon Russell covering Bob Dylan, featuring Jesse Ed Davis. What does that sound good to you, Doug?
Sounds great.
KSQD thanks Meals on Wheels, Salinas Valley, for supporting this program. They believe that no senior should go hungry, and their diverse programs offer more than a meal. In addition to delivering meals to homebound seniors, they host monthly lunch socials that include live music, access to local resources, and more, held throughout the Salinas Valley. For more information, 831-758-6325 or mowsalinas.org. Thank you, Meals on Wheels, Salinas Valley, for supporting K-Squid, 90.7, 89.5, and 89.7 FM.
Hard rain's going to fall. I have not seen No Direction, what is it, Complete Unknown yet, Douglas Miller, history professor, but I don't know if I will see it. I don't know. I've, as a true Dylan fanatic, I've made that movie in my head so many times, I don't necessarily need to see somebody else make it. But I know there's a big scene where Bob is writing, A Hard Rain is Going to Fall, and an enduring classic, Leon Russell. And is it safe to say Jesse Davis was one of the Shelter people?
Yeah, well, sort of. By the way, it was just really great listening to that. I haven't heard it in a while, and it just sucked me right in. What a great groove. Leon Russell is underrated as a Bob Dylan interpreter, in my humble opinion. That was cool. Leon, oh boy, what was the question? What did I do?
Was he a Shelter people? Was Jesse clearly? I always wonder who the Shelter people were. As I said to you earlier, you know, Leon Russell ran a cult. He was like the benign, user-friendly Charles Manson. You know, he had the hair going and the cult-like devotion, except he, of course, was a totally good guy. And unlike Charles Manson, was not a frustrated musician. People could not get enough of Leon Russell, including Elton John, who just worships and still worships. Leon Russell.
Well, sure, yeah. Well, you know, if you study the liner notes to that album really closely, and I had to do a lot of that to make this book, that particular group on that cut, Carl Radle on bass, the great Jim Keltner on drums, and Jesse Davis on guitar, the Leon christened them the Tulsa Tops, the Tulsa Tops, even though Jesse wasn't from Tulsa. He was an Oklahoma City cat. But the Shelter people, that refers to the record label that Leon started called Shelter, of course, with Denny Cordell. I don't know if Jesse's a Shelter person. I think he's a Tulsa Top, at least according to the album notes.
And a point out, if we're getting into Dylan trivia, Jim Keltner is just got off the road from touring with Bob Dylan. So Jim Keltner's back, 80-year-old, 80-plus Jim Keltner is still playing with Bob Dylan, who he backed up in the Born Again tour in 80-81, incredibly great drummer. Well, let's get Dylan and Jesse, Ed, and Leon back in the studio. He played Watching the River Flow, a classic song, and you got into the Bob Dylan Center in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And one of the few people, I was unaware that there were outtakes to this. I know they got together in 1971. Give us a little background where there's one more song we haven't played from that session. But how on earth did that all happen? Dylan wasn't at his most productive. And Watching the River Flow, Dylan, as always, says it best, "What's the matter with me? I don't have much to say," which was pretty much truth in advertising with that particular song. What was going on in that studio that day?
Yeah, well, that lyric will make even further sense when I give you a little context here. So now the tune we just heard, Leon Russell's cover of Hard Rain's Gonna Fall, was part of a package of Dylan covers that Leon put together with Keltner, Radle, and Jesse Ed Davis as a birthday present to Bob Dylan. And in the meantime, Leon had been asking Bob if it's true that he can just write a song on the spot with absolutely no planning, you know, just can he just pick up a piece of paper and a pen and put something together? Because Leon had heard this about Bob over the years. And Dylan said, well, you know, yeah, it's true. I guess I can do that. And Bob said, I'll tell you what, to prove it, why don't you bring, you know, your band, the same guys who cut that song we just heard, why don't you bring him out to the studio with me and I'll show you how I do it. So these guys end up in New York City at Blue Rock Studios, and Bob is quite literally walking around with a notepad and a pencil, and Leon and Jesse and the guys are trying to like look over his shoulder to see what he's writing down. And meanwhile, They're kind of cooking up some tunes. So when we hear Watching the River Flow and When I Paint My Masterpiece, you know, that's kind of under the direction of Leon in terms of the music. Anyway, you know, at some point Bob said, okay, I got something. And they just start in on this tune that becomes Watching the River Flow, When I Paint My Masterpiece. And Bob proved it. He really could just, you know, write up a song on the spot. And there are two songs that must be held in such high regard by Bob himself that he plays them still to this day in his live set, both of those tunes, with, as you mentioned, the great Jim Keltner on drums.
And you don't hear, yeah, Bob's not playing Blowin' in the Wind. Bob's not playing Hard Rain's Gonna Fall. Bob's not playing Mr. Tambourine Man. He's playing Watching the River Flow and When I Paint My Masterpiece. So we already heard Watching the River Flow, and it would be, I think the FCC would take us off the radio if we didn't play the second song in that set. So this is, I will say one thing. I think Watching the River Flow would have been the Make It Up in the Studio song. I'm pretty sure Bob had Masterpiece because the band had put it out on Cahoots and he'd covered it for New Morning. So he might have – I don't know if he wrote that one in session. I'm sure this arrangement is utterly Leon, but I think he had the song, or at least most of the song. But this is definitely a one-of-a-kind. And you heard all the different outtakes. Did you hear alternate Masterpieces or –
Yeah, you got me thinking now because I think I wrestled with the question of Masterpiece. And, you know, Jesse remembered Bob writing the lyrics to When I Paint My Masterpiece, talking about, you know, it's like this old sort of biblical kind of stuff. And right, this was in June of 71. And I know there's that piano demo of Bob doing the tune that's on that New Morning box set, bootleg series set. But I'm not sure where they lined up. I thought that maybe Masterpiece is straight from these sessions too. Either way, we'll get to the bottom of it. There were other songs that they recorded that day. There were even more than what the most, you know, sort of deepest Dylanologists knew about. There are about 7, 8, 9 other tunes. They were all cover songs. Old songs like Blood Red River and I'm a Ladies Man. Might be fool enough to try. Just some really incredible music that I had the immense privilege to hear. I had to kind of sign away my life, you know, and make sure that I wasn't doing any kind of illegal recording in the archive over there in Tulsa where I could sneak these things out. I just had to hear them on their system, on their headphones. And it was incredible. Everything from that session is really remarkable. And I hope that Bob's people We'll see the light in that and put that stuff out for everyone to hear someday because it's really impressive.
Well, Bob did put this one out on the Greatest Hits Volume 2 back in 1971. So Bob thought it was good enough then, and he's still playing it now.
For the streets of Rome are filled with rubble, aged footprints are everywhere. You can almost think that you're seeing double on a cold, dark night on the Spanish stairs. Hurry on back to my hotel room, where I've got me a date with Botticelli's niece. Yup, she promised that she'd be right there with me, but I paid my masterpiece. Oh, the hours that I've spent inside the Coliseum, dodging lions and wasting time. Oh, those mighty kings of the jungle, I could hardly stand to see them. Yes, it sure has been a long, hard climb. Train reels running through the back of my memory,
as the daylight hours do increase. Someday everything is gonna be smooth like a rhapsody. When I paint my masterpiece. I left the road and landed in Brussels, with a picture of a tall oak tree by my side. Clergymen in uniform and young girls pulling muscles. Everyone was there and nobody tried to hide. Newspaper men eating candy had to be held down by big police. Someday everything is gonna be different when I paint my masterpiece.
Well, Nobel Prize winning lyricist who rhymes museum and stand to see 'em. You got to love Bob Dylan. When I paint my masterpiece. I'm here with Douglas Miller, author of the book Ouachita Love Child, a great biography of not just the great musician Jesse Ed Davis, but the entire Tulsa music scene, the indigenous community of Oklahoma, all the tributaries that led to Jesse Ed Davis and beyond. And it's a joy to speak with you about this guy's life and times, because attention must be paid, and you've paid great attention to it. Let's talk about the solo albums. We played Ouachita Love Child from the first Jesse Ed Davis. We have a couple. We have a track from the couple of things from the second. Ululu, is that how you pronounce it? Jesse Ed Davis solo album?
Ululu, yeah. And you know, while I was sitting here listening to that, because I have that new morning set right here next to me on the shelf, I pulled it down. And that, When I Paint My Masterpiece piano demo, is from that same Blue Rock session dates. So I don't know if Bob at some point during the session just wanted to just try it out on his own or something, and that's that version. But at the very least, they're from the same session. So maybe Jesse and Leon's memory was correct on that. Anyway, that's neither here nor there, but I'm still learning about it. I'm still trying to get it right. And you don't do a book like this if you don't have a kind of obsessive mind.
And I know musicians are not always the most reliable witnesses, you know, and the closer you get to try to do any scholarship on Bob Dylan, unless you're actually going to the Tulsa Center and putting on the headphones and taking notes and looking at the – listening to the slates, it's tough to kind of capture that guy in a bottle.
Yeah, Jesse wasn't always a reliable narrator himself, which made the book very challenging at times.
But tell me about the solo records. He had three.
Sure thing.
Jesse Davis, Ululu, and yeah. Keep Me Coming. And we have a couple – you have the playlist in front of you. Tee us up. We'll play a couple things from those because like all – great musicians, there's the inevitable solo album, and these were serious works. He put a lot of effort into them. And what happened? Were they, you know, just the tee us up here for something?
Well, while he was in London in May 1970, at the end of a Taj Mahal tour, Jesse told Taj he's going to hang back in England for a while. He's not going to go back to the States. And that he had decided he wanted to leave the Taj Mahal band. And Jesse had these guys, Clapton and Lennon and all these cats, the Rolling Stones, who were all really interested in him and wanted to play with him some and get to know him better. And I think Jesse saw an opportunity there. So he's at Eric Clapton's house, and Clapton calls Jerry Wexler and tells him all about his new friend, Jesse Ed Davis, and how Wexler, the great music mogul who had produced Aretha Franklin and so forth, and executive at Atlantic Records. Clapton put Jesse on the phone with Wexler, and a few minutes later, Jesse hung up the phone and he had an album deal sketched out for ATCO, an imprint within the Atlantic Records label. And Jesse started working on the record right there in London at Olympia Studios with Glenn Johns engineering and Clapton guesting, as we heard earlier on Wachita Love Child. The album didn't do too well. As Jesse once said himself, it sold in the high hundreds. And I don't think he was kidding. And he got to cut one more album for ATCO. I think that that was the deal he had. And that second album is called Ululu. The first one came out in early 71 and Ululu came out in 72. And neither album really took off, much to Jesse's disappointment and frustration. Meanwhile, Jesse's keeping up gigs as a session musician and as a sort of sideman and a producer as well. He was producing Gene Clark and Roger Tillison and other artists. And I think Jesse struggled to kind of get his career in alignment in terms of getting on one particular path. Anyway, just to wrap up this point, there will be a third solo album called Keep Me Coming in 1973, but this one would be with Epic Records after his ATCO deal had run out. Jesse thought Keep Me Coming, his third album, was his best album. I think it is too, for that matter, but it's the one that fewer people have heard. In fact, I've met Jesse A. Davis fans who didn't even know there was a third album, Keep Me Coming.
Well, what an astonishing coincidence. We have the title track to Keep Me Coming right here. So let's have a listen. So if you're a new Jesse Ed Davis fan, you haven't heard this. And even if you're an old Jesse Ed Davis fan, you may not have heard this particular song.
Thank you. This is Paul Hine, and I'm one of the hosts of the weekly music show Runs on Grasoline. If you like bluegrass, folk, and Americana music, tune in to KSQD 90.7 FM Saturdays at 2 p.m. Runs on Grasoline here on K-Squid, community radio for the Monterey Bay Area.
That's Keep Me Coming, Jessica Davis, the third and obscure-er solo album. This is Eric Nelson. I'm here with Douglas Miller, Professor Douglas Miller. You're classing up the joint, as I said earlier, author of Ouachita Love Child, which is a great deep dive into the life and times of Jessica Davis. And we're now where the times are going to get dark. And this is a sad, if this were a traditional music biography, we would have John Lennon in The Lost Weekend turn Jesse on to heroin or something, but that's not how it went down. But we're going to get in now to, we've talked about John Lennon, let's get into The Lost Weekend and Lennon and Jessica Davis. That was a real, that was on one hand a great friend to have, John Lennon, but not necessarily in 1973-74.
Yeah, I mean, they had a deep sort of brotherly bond almost beyond the music that they made together. I'm hoping that, you know, if sort of John Lennon enthusiasts haven't found the book already, that they'll pick it up, because I think there's some interesting episodes and impressions in there that we get from Jesse's side of the story that tell us a little more about John Lennon that hasn't already been published. These guys loved each other and made some really great music together, but you know, sometimes they could get into some bad situations. So 1973-74, John Lennon is out in Los Angeles, essentially under orders from Yoko to go, you know, kind of get his yayas out and get straightened out. And Yoko pairs him up with their assistant named May Pang to look after John. And as I understand it, Yoko kind of even encouraged John to spend some time with May, if you catch my drift. And May Pang kind of sincerely fell in love with John Lennon and was trying to help him, you know, advance his solo career, but out in Los Angeles instead of New York. And that's where Jessica Davis comes into the picture again after he first met Lennon back in London in 1968. They make a couple great albums together, but they also get into a lot of trouble as John gets into some pretty, you know, out of control bouts of drinking and partying. And Jesse's right there with him as his right hand man and sometimes encourages the worst in John, I hate to say.
And vice versa. And, you know, well, this becomes a death spiral. It starts in 74 and would take Jessica Davis in 88. You know, he battled addictions, battled his internal demons, and yet still managed to perform, play and produce and be that kind of beacon of musical light that he always was. And the last half hour of this look at Jessica Davis, we're going to start playing some of that stuff. Well, let's play one of the songs. This is Jessica Davis is on this song. I think Number 9 Dream, what album was that on?
Walls and Bridges.
Walls and Bridges. So this is John Lennon with Jessica Davis in the vortex of what they called the Lost Weekend that went on for quite a few months.
Thank you.
that song doesn't have Jesse Ed Davis like up front and center on guitar, but it's infused with Jesse Ed Davis. Don't you agree?
Yeah, I mean, he's there with the great slide guitar, the sort of evocative stuff that he's doing, that textural stuff. And Jesse mentioned, this is, you know, his first person voice, that he was intentionally trying to capture George Harrison's slide guitar sound on that. He loved George's guitar playing. He was pals with George, too, and wanted to infuse the song with a little bit of that George Harrison sound.
Well, we've got, he's certainly sat in with a lot of, when you're talking big fan, Stones were fans, John Lennon, Harrison, and the Byrds. You mentioned earlier that he produced a Gene Clark record. And Gene Clark, of course, the songwriter of the Byrds, I won't say a tortured artist, but, you know, had his demons as so many of these guys did. How did he and Jesse became a producer at this point for Gene Clark?
Yeah, Jesse and Gene Clark's bond was as deep as that of, you know, Jesse and John Lennon, maybe even deeper. The sort of Jesse's relationship with Gene Clark, at least for me, is some of the most interesting stuff in the book that I wrote. They had known each other just from the L.A. scene. The Taj Mahal band had done gigs with the Byrds. These guys had sort of been around each other. And Jesse and Gene just became big fans of each other, so much so that Jesse produced Gene Clark's album White Light, and then would go on to work with Gene on his No Other album, not as producer, but as a guitar player. Later on down the road, these guys are going to have a band together in Hawaii called Smoky Road. It's one of the most obscure parts of Jesse Ed Davis's story and something very few people knew anything about that I write about at length in the book. Yeah.
Well, this song, this is the song 1975 from the album White Light, and it's a beautiful, this has, unlike the Lennon track where, and I actually thought, Doug, before you said that, I thought that was George Harrison. It sounded exactly like George Harrison's slide guitar, you know, and that's to Jesse Ed's credit. This is kind of Jesse a little raw in a record that he produced called White Light with Gene Clark, but there's no doubt who's playing guitar in this particular song.
With all the legends that the century sings and its vision bring to life, while foreign waters breathe against the shore and the wind plays o'er its rusted fires, I see the ships of a friendly fleet and the song so sweetly sounding, and gentle souls who think not to defeat, as across the waves they are bounding. And then the thoughts of all the days this time, they have been confined without reason, and in the matters of their health and wealth, they cannot be defined, but it's treason. But go where and find a better life, as in the name of love you have freed them. And those you need not, you have left behind, and those you keep in mind, know to eat them. Across the bridge, across the river, where we've never been before, within and out of worlds around us, and in the light of finding more. She always easy understood that it was no good not to explore, but never really understood that it was no good just to
ignore. Doubt who's on guitar there. It's a great solo.
Sure is.
And another artist who, again, we're now in deep into sessions, David Blue. Speaking of a Dylan follow traveler, Dylan's on the Rolling Thunder review, certainly part of the movie, which I think probably can't see the original Rolling Thunder movie that Dylan did. Even at the Tulsa Center, it's under wraps. But David Blue is another doomed figure from that era. And you asked for a song from that. Go ahead, tell me why.
I sure did, and I prevail on this one in the book. You know, I tell readers up front, I can't discuss every song and album Jesse Ed Davis played on, my lord. But I do, I do try to pick out a few songs that I think didn't receive as much attention in his story to this point. And this is one, right, that I asked if we could play Cordelia from David Blue's Cupid's Arrow album. I don't know how Jesse got on the session exactly, but look who he's playing with here. We're going to have Levon Helm on drums, Donald Duck Dunn on bass, and those were associates of Jesse Ed Davis already. We're going to have the great David Lindley on lap steel, and Auburn Burrell on pedal steel, and Jesse Ed Davis playing his Telecaster. And I love to just listen to what Jesse does in the center of this song, sort of setting the spine, if you will.
Cordelia, Cordelia, has it been more than a year? It feels like yesterday you were here. And Cordelia, Cordelia, the wonder seen on the streets of Buffalo.
You're right, Douglas Miller. That is a beautiful, beautiful song. Rises above the parts of all those great musicians. David Blue, Cordelia, with Jesse Ed Davis. You're listening to the, final moments here, final 15 minutes of a two-hour salute to Jesse Ed Davis with Douglas Miller, history professor, Professor Douglas Miller. Can't say that enough. From OSU, written a great book, Washita Love Child, about Jesse Ed Davis. So the high water mark and the death knell in some ways for Jesse Ed Davis, if you want to be simplistic, was the fall of 1975 when he collides with Rod Stewart in The Faces. Can you give us a quick overview of how that came to be and what its impact was on Jesse?
Well, Jesse was in the running to be the Rolling Stones guitarist who would play replace Mick Taylor. And I know that list is about 500 names long, and Jesse's never on it as far as I ever see, but he really was kind of in the final cut. Ronnie Wood ends up getting the gig while Ronnie Wood is still in The Faces. And Jesse's consolation prize, I suppose, was to go out on the road with that arena rock group. And he's a full member. He becomes a full member, but within a matter of months, the band breaks up after their tour in 1975. And Jesse's kind of left in the lurch, just as he was the year prior when John Lennon quickly, unceremoniously moved back to New York City. So at this time, and I'm careful here not to, I don't want to blame any person for Jesse's battle of drug addiction. That's a very complicated thing. But certainly in 1975, Jesse's losing whatever grip you can possibly have on heroin. And eventually, you know, 13 years later, it takes him down at a moment when he was really coming back with the Graffiti Band, as I said at the top of our episode.
Well, let's talk about Graffiti Man, the artist, you know, that whole project. We're kind of circling back now to the beginning. We talked about February of 1987, Bob Dylan. This album was Bob Dylan's, one of his favorite records of the year, and he didn't care who knew that he felt that way. There's superstar jams, and there's Jesse Ed Davis, George Harrison, Bob Dylan, and John Fogerty. And I believe that Dylan said John Fogerty, who had refused adamantly to perform any Creedence Clearwater songs, "You got to do Proud Mary. You don't want Tina Turner to own the song now, do you?" which you got to love. But tell me about that relationship, who John is and his relationship with Jesse.
Yeah, I'm glad we came back here, because if we have time for just one more song, I hope it will be Beauty in a Fade.
That's where we're heading.
Which, hey, all right. Well, you know, Jesse was in a rehabilitation center, the American Indian Eagle Lodge, for drug and alcohol treatment for Native people in Los Angeles. And somebody brought into the center this cassette tape of John Trudell reading his poetry over the top of traditional tribal music. And Jesse fell in love with this cassette that was playing on the boom box in the recreation room.
Tell me, though, John Trudell. Yeah. Who's John Trudell, for people who don't
know? John Trudell had been a leader of the Alcatraz Island occupation from 1969 to 1971 on behalf of Native American people's sovereignty and self-determination rights. He was a sort of prominent person as an activist in Indian country. And then in the 80s, he was working as a poet, as a spoken word performer. Anyway, Jesse was like the first person on the bus on this field trip to go see Trudell perform at out in Long Beach. And this is May 1st, 1985. And after John's set, Jesse approached him and said, "I can put music to your words." And that's exactly what those guys did together for 3 years before Jesse passed. In the book, and I'll say it again here now, I suggest that perhaps Beauty in a Fade with John and Jesse is Jesse Ed Davis's greatest music moment, perhaps in my humble opinion.
Let's hear. That was the lecture. This is the lab.
Sort of love. She was a beautiful woman, but he did a lot of ugly things to turn her world around. In his own way, he loved her too, trying to be his own man, conquer the world when he couldn't. She became his last stand. He was cowboys, she was Indians. Some beauty fades in too many ugly seeds. Glows from flush of love turn to flickering hopes. Falling from the clouds when somebody leads. Today too early for the future, too late for the past. What happens to love, the kind that lasts? She wanted what she needed. He needed what he wanted. Being in two worlds, existing as one. Confined in the walls of their relationship. Becoming hammers, tearing the walls down. Once they shared the same dream. Ends up, they both had canvas of their own. And their own paint. Then they saw they only brought one frame. Her part of the dream alone was bigger than that. A man, a woman, a sort of love.
That is a great way to see Jesse Ed Davis off Douglas Miller, don't you think?
Absolutely, yeah.
Well, we're not quite done yet. First, Doug, I want to thank you for joining us for the last 2 hours. Boy, did time fly. You know, I told you we could have gone 3-4 hours. There's just so much in Jessie Davis's life and music to play, but we did what we could. The book is Ouachita Love Child. You can get it where most fine books are sold, and it hooked me in and led directly to this radio show, so I cannot recommend it enough, and thank you for joining. But let's go off, and maybe, Doug, you can set this up. Jackson Brown, we're going to set up. If people think of Jessie Davis's guitar solo, this is maybe – they didn't maybe put the artist with the guitar, but now in the last 2 hours, you know what to listen for. So tell the story about how this came to be.
Yeah, well, this is perfect because this wasn't invented for the book. It's true that my earliest memories in life were of listening to Jackson Brown's first album containing this great song. So special for me. But Jackson invited Jessie into the studio in 1972 when he was working on – his first solo album, the one we often call Saturate Before Using. And they had a song up ready for Jessie to play on. And Jessie said, "I don't hear myself on that." And Jackson and the engineer kind of look at each other. Well, that's what we thought we were doing, right? And so they put on another song Jackson had been cooking up called Doctor My Eyes. And Jessie said, "Okay, yeah, I can do that." And Jessie goes out to the studio floor, puts the headphones on. They roll the tape. Jessie kind of stops and, you know, says, is that what I'm in? Is that where the solo? Yeah, yeah, okay. Says, okay, start it over. They hit record. Jessie plays through it. They stop. And Jackson and the engineer say, "All right, well, you're getting warmed up. You want to try it a couple more times?" And Jessie said, "No, that's it. That was it. That's the take. That's the one." The point is, Jessie just made up that great guitar solo right on the spot. He had never even heard the complete song. And that's the actual version that became Jackson Brown's first top 10 hit.
Well, can't do better than that for a setup. Doug, thank you so much for joining. And this would be, well, you've heard about, again, that was the lecture, this is the lab, one of the most famous guitar solos, certainly in Jackson Brown history, and a great way to see Jessie Davis off. Thank you, Doug, for joining.
Thank you.
Dr. Maya.
To my eyes.